Turn to Leviticus chapter 24, and we have two chapters that we want to cover in this session. I'm really amazed how easy it is covering Leviticus this time. Like last time I went through Leviticus in 10 sessions, it was kind of rushed, but we've allowed sessions this year for it, and we're really getting to take it pretty easy. Got to just session one chapter yesterday, and two chapters today, and two tomorrow, and that'll close it out. So this is really, I feel, a good rate to take this material. Although Leviticus is not an easy book to enjoy, unless you have some, you know, unless you do have some deep insights than what you just see on the surface, because it does tend to be a little tedious and technical and repetitious and I would even say boring. Some people have found it to be, if you can believe that. But as you know, once we begin to see the spiritual types in it, it's a quite interesting book. And I'm glad that we were able to take it this slowly so we can spend time on each of these chapters as we have. Now in chapter 24, it's kind of miscellaneous stuff in this chapter. There's primarily four subjects that are addressed in the chapter, and they're not necessarily very much related to each other. First of all, in the first four verses, it talks about the oil for the lamps in the tabernacle. You remember that the tabernacle, the holy place, not the holy of holies, but the holy place of the tabernacle, was lit by a golden candlestick of seven branches. And this candlestick was of pure gold, and it was to be kept burning, and the oil was to be of the finest olive oil. And really what we read in chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, is simply a repetition of what was already commanded earlier in the book of Exodus, that the people should bring this oil, provide the oil for the lamps, and it does say it shall burn continually in verse 2, to cause the lamps to burn continually. Now, I must say, on some of the things we're going to study here, I'm not real clear on how things worked out in real life, because there are some places in the Scripture that almost indicate that the lamps were lit every morning and went out at night. I could give you perhaps some, I don't know, well, like for instance in First Samuel, we have a passage that I must say I've always found difficult to understand, but it has to do with when the boy Samuel ministered in the tabernacle under Eli. It says in 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verses 2 and 3, "It came to pass at that time when Eli was laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim that he could not see. And ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was, and Samuel was laid down to sleep, that the Lord called to Samuel." That statement in verse 3, "and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of God," I must say I've had a lot of different questions in my mind as to what that's referring to. Whether it's talking about the time of day, for instance in the evening when the lamp had not yet gone out, as though it went out at night and they trimmed it in the morning and lit it again, or whether there's something more spiritual implied in that statement, as if the, in a sense, the spiritual light of Israel was about to be snuffed at that point until Samuel came along. Because it says in the verse before that, in verse 1, there was, the word of the Lord was precious or rare in those days, and there was no open vision. So in a sense, the lamp of Israel was almost out. But there are some places in the Scriptures that indicate that, it seemed to indicate that the lamps were lit every morning, although it says they should be burned continually. In Exodus 27... we have the passage that's somewhat parallel to what we're reading here in Leviticus. In chapter 27, in verses 20 and 21, it says, "And thou shalt command the children of Israel that they bring thee pure oil, olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn always in the tabernacle of the congregation without the veil, which is before the testimony. Aaron and his sons shall order it from evening to morning before the Lord." Now, what it means to order it from evening to morning, I'm not real clear. That means, of course, when the sun goes down until the sun goes up, the sons of Aaron are supposed to do something with it. And since they don't have the lamp anymore, and they haven't had it for many centuries, there's no one alive today who could be very certain exactly how this was done, but the Jews certainly must have known, and we're kind of left without a lot of information about it. I would just maybe turn your attention also to 2 Chronicles 13. It's talking about what the priests do in 2 Chronicles 11. Says, and they burn unto the Lord every morning and every evening burnt sacrifices and sweet incense. The showbread also set they in order upon the table, and the candlestick of gold with the lamps thereof to burn every evening. For we keep the charge of the Lord our God. Now, it sounds like they burn the lamp of the Lord every evening. I don't know if this means that it became customary for them to light it at night and burn it from evening to morning, or it seems like it was burning during the day also. But the fact of the matter is, the actual way that these ceremonies were practiced is not given in enough detail for us to be certain, in my opinion. Now, I've read different people say what they think it was, but the Bible's kind of sketchy in what it tells us. All we have in Leviticus 24, verses 1 through 4, is a repetition of what was already said in Exodus chapter 27 about the same subject. That is, that the children of Israel are supposed to provide oil for the lamps to burn, and the sons of Aaron have some charge over it, whether it means they trim the lamps in the morning or at night or kept it going always. By the way, in saying that the lamps would burn continually, we would usually use that expression and understand it to mean that they would burn day and night, and never go out, and you continually feed them with oil. But the term could also mean that forever the burning of the lamps will be a ritual among the Jews, whether it's day and night or not, but that it'll be a continual ordinance, that whenever they burn, whether they burn them at night or in the daytime or whatever they do, that it'll be a continuing ordinance, and it would not necessarily mean that they're burning day and night. So there's enough ambiguity about the passage that we can just kind of scratch our heads and say, well, we don't fully understand what the ritual of the lampstand was. But we can say that the lampstand almost certainly represented either Christ or the church. In the book of Revelation, you remember chapter 1 and verse 20, the seven golden candlesticks that John saw in his vision represent the seven churches. And that is slightly a different image than this candlestick, because John saw seven separate candlesticks, whereas this was a seven-branched candlestick. We might see it that the candlestick represents Christ, the light of the world. And as John saw the seven candlesticks, it's almost like Christ was broken up into his individual members in the churches. Christ was represented and the light of the world was broken up into seven different congregations in that book of Revelation. At any rate, the light, the gold, the solid, pure gold candlestick represents the pure gold of Christ's character, and the continual burning, whether it's day and night or whatever, represents, of course, the light that Jesus gives to the world. And it was the only light that was to be found in that part of the tabernacle building. The next part of the chapter, verses 6 through 9, then talk about the showbread. And again, this is not new. It basically repeats what was said earlier in Exodus chapter 25 about how the bread was to be made, put on the 12 loaves were to be put on the table of showbread, and there for a week, and then on the Sabbath, the priest would eat the showbread from the previous week. And so you've talked about all those things with John when you went through the book of Exodus, and there's not really any need for us to go over that material again, because there's nothing new in it. But there is something new in verses 10 through 16. And this is the second and last historical incident to be found in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is mainly made up of just rules and laws, and there's not very much in the way of telling any stories about any historical incidents that happen. The only two there are have to do with the death of Nadab and Abihu in chapter 10, and then this one, which has to do with the death of another offender. In verse 10 it says, and the son of an Israelitish woman, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the children of Israel, and this son of the Israelitish woman and a man of Israel strove together in the camp. And the Israelitish woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed. And they brought him unto Moses. His mother's name was Shelomith, the daughter of Dibri, the tribe of Dan. And they put him in ward, that means they locked him up, they kept him in custody until the mind of the Lord might show them. That is, they weren't quite sure what to do with him, so they put him in custody until the Lord would give an answer. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, bring forth him that hath cursed outside the camp, and let all heard him lay their hands upon his head, and let all the congregation stone him. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, Whosoever curses his God shall bear his sin. And he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death. And all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well the stranger as he that is born in the land. When he blasphemeth the name of the Lord, shall he be put to death. Now, it had already been stated in earlier passages that to blaspheme God, or even to curse your parents, was punishable by death. How much more to curse God? I mean, if you cursed your parents and you'd be stoned to death for that, it would be obvious that cursing God would incur at least as serious a punishment. However, Moses was not a rash man. When things like this happened, he didn't hastily say, okay, let's kill the guy. But he really wanted to get the mind of the Lord about things. In this, Moses showed a little more wisdom than Joshua did later when, for instance, the Gibeonites came to Joshua pretending to be members of a distant land and made a covenant with him, which he wouldn't have made if he'd known their real identity. And he was deceived. And it says in Joshua, where he made this covenant with the Gibeonites, he didn't consult the Lord. Joshua did not consult the Lord about this thing, and he was ended up being deceived and making a wrong decision. Moses was a little more careful and did consult the Lord, although he probably knew what the answer from the Lord was going to be. He didn't want to be rash, and so he put the man aside for a while in custody to seek God and to get an answer. It's kind of nice when a leader doesn't just operate on principle alone or on, you know, his pat answers, or just open the book and say, well, what's it say here? But where he really waits on the Lord to make sure he has the mind of the Lord, as it says here, on a matter. Although, certainly in the Scriptures, we have the mind of the Lord. This was a case where whether the man should be stoned or something else should be done to him needed to be known from God. There's another case, a very similar case, that occurred in the book of Numbers, where a man broke the law and God, or Moses put him in ward to wait and see what God would say. It's in Numbers chapter 15. And story of a man who was caught gathering sticks on the Sabbath. It says in Numbers 15, verse 32, And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day. And they found him gathering sticks, or they that found him gathering sticks, brought him unto Moses and Aaron and unto all the congregation. And they put him in ward, because it was not declared what should be done to him. And the Lord said to Moses, that the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp, or outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. Here another case where a man is breaking the law, and Moses, instead of immediately getting angry and decreeing a hasty judgment, puts the man in ward for a while to seek the Lord and ask the Lord what to be done. So Moses was a man who really wanted to know that he was doing what God commanded most of the times. Unfortunately, Moses' tragic flaw in his life was that on one occasion, he knew what God wanted him to do and didn't do it. And that's when God told him to speak to the rock, but instead he smote it. And that cost him his entrance into the promised land. But for the most part, Moses showed himself to be a man who really wanted to know the mind of the Lord and a good leader as a result of that. One of the best leaders that Israel ever had. Now, this man in the story in Leviticus is said to have been the son of an Israelitish woman. That means he was only half Jewish. His father, we're told, was an Egyptian. Now, we don't know anything about the identity of his father, but the Jews have a tradition, the rabbis have a tradition, that this man was the son of the Egyptian that Moses slew 40 years earlier. Remember when Moses found an Egyptian smiting an Israelite, and Moses slew the man and hid his body? According to the rabbis, that Egyptian that Moses slew 40 years earlier was the father of this man. But there's absolutely nothing in the Scripture to support it. It's just kind of interesting, all the traditions the Jews have about things like that. However, since this man was an adult, and since his father was an Egyptian and his mother was a Jewess, it seems clear that he was born in Egypt before the Exodus at a time when the Jews were slaves of the Egyptians. And therefore, his mother had probably been either either raped by an Egyptian overlord, or else perhaps she was a concubine of his, made one of his concubines, and therefore this man was probably an illegitimate child. He didn't have a claim to an inheritance among the children of Israel. Now, his mother was of the tribe of Dan, it says. But he would not have been able to encamp with the rest of the tribe of Dan because of his mixed parentage. And according to the Jewish rabbis, again, who don't necessarily have the truth on the matter, but this is their tradition, there was a dispute that arose because the man wanted to pitch his tent with the rest of the tribe of Dan, but he wasn't permitted to because of his Egyptian father. And when the dispute was brought to Moses, this is all according to the rabbis, the dispute was brought to Moses, and Moses decreed against the man in the matter, and then, because the man was dissatisfied with the decree, he began to curse Jehovah and blaspheme and so forth. And that's when Moses put him in war. Now, that fills in some details of the story, but we can't be certain that they're true. That's just the way the rabbis tell the story. But it adds more color to the story, at least. Well, they're artificial coloring. What God said to do to this man who blasphemed was that the people who heard him should lay their hands on his head. This, of course, symbolizes that they're casting the guilt back on him. They have been defiled. Their ears have been defiled by hearing blasphemy against God. Therefore, they put the defilement back on him. Those who heard him put their hands on his head, signifying that the defilement and the guilt of it is back on his head. He's the one who did it. They were innocent bystanders. And then they, because they are the witnesses of the crime, stone him to death. Now, there's some things to observe about this. One is that today we would consider this a rather excessive penalty for such a blunder. People today blaspheme God all the time. I must say that whenever I hear it, I do feel a little defiled. Not that I feel guilty. I just feel like, you know, I've been subjected wrongly to certain defilement that I didn't ask for, you know. And sometimes I feel like going up and talking to a blasphemer about it. Though I haven't very often done that, to tell you the truth. Maybe I should. But because it is so common with modern people to blaspheme God, we think of it as an extremely harsh punishment to kill a man for doing so. But the punishment is not extreme. It is we who've been numbed to the severity of the crime that's what makes it seem extreme to us. When we read the Bible and see that God has decreed that a man who blasphemes God should be put to death, what we're reading is really what a person deserves, and in light of the weight of that crime. To blaspheme the name of God renders a man worthy of death. Now, I would dare say that if I asked for a show of hands, many of you would have to say that at one time in your life, prior to becoming a Christian, you may have uttered blasphemies against God, or at least used his name irreverently. We don't know exactly what this man said. It just says he blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed. But I would say most of us, at one time in our lives, we're very unusual people before we're Christians, did similar things. And what we have to realize is when we read that God had such people stoned to death, that's exactly what that sin deserves. And when we see people doing it around us, rather than be numbed to it and say, well, it must not be that serious a thing because everybody does it, realize that everybody's out doing things that God says are worthy of death. And we have to appreciate the holiness of the name of God. The first four commandments in the Ten Commandments all have to do with preserving the holiness of God and His uniqueness. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make graven images of God. You shall not take the name of the Lord in vain. You shall keep the Sabbath holy. These are all commands that have to do with sanctifying the Lord God in your hearts. Treating God as something holy and unique, and not dragging Him down to our level and thinking that He's like us and that we can just trample upon His name or misrepresent His identity by graven images, or in the case where the Sabbath was a requirement for people to keep, to take that day which is God's holy day and to do with it whatever we want to. It's very clear that what God separates as holy has got to be treated as holy, and those who trample upon the holiness of God by ignoring things like the sanctity of God's name or the sanctity of the Sabbath or whatever, people are doing something very gross in the sight of heaven, and something damnable, something worthy of death. And we can easily become anesthetized to it and think very little of it because we just hear it so much. But You know, once you live in a Christian community for a while, you don't hear that anymore for most of the time. And then you go back out in the real world where you hear it again, and you suddenly, you're shocked back into the reality that there are people who still use the name of Jesus Christ irreverently. It's kind of shocking after you've lived among Christians for a while to go out again and hear these criminals, you know, criminals against God's law, who are doing things worthy of death. I mean, if God were here ruling in Bandon, you know, and executing penalties for the violation of His laws, there'd be a lot of names on death row. You know, that's a big thing to blaspheme the name of God. Yet we think so lightly of it very often, just because it is common. Now, this, I will say, does seem to be the first time that stoning to death was prescribed as the method of killing a blasphemer. And so this set a precedent in the Jewish law, which was observed forever afterward, though I don't know that the Jews always enforced it. They certainly tried to enforce it against Jesus when they thought He was blaspheming. You remember how many times, especially in the Gospel of John, it mentions that when Jesus made some radical statement about His own deity, He was accused of blasphemy. And remember what the Jews did? They took up stones to stone Him, because that is what was prescribed here in Leviticus to be done to a blasphemer, that men be stoned to death. You might look at a couple places like that in John's Gospel. In John chapter 8, beginning with verse 56 and through 59, Jesus said to the Pharisees, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Then said the Jews unto him, You are not yet 50 years old, and hast thou seen Abraham? And Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Then took they up stones to cast at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." Why did they take up stones? Because he said, I am, which was, of course, the name of Jehovah, the name of God, and he was applying it to himself. They were considering that this was blasphemy. And if any ordinary man did say such things and applied the divine name to himself, that would be blasphemy. And stoning would be quite appropriate. The only thing is, of course, Jesus was uniquely qualified to use the name of Jehovah for himself because he was God. If you turn two chapters later in John chapter 10, beginning with verse 30, Jesus said, I and my Father are one. Verse 31, then the Jews took up stones again to stone him. And Jesus answered them, Many good works have I showed you from my Father. For which of those works do you stone me? And the Jews answered him, saying, For a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, and because that thou, being a man, makest thyself God. So here, they thought Jesus to be blaspheming because he was making himself God. And there were other occasions too. For instance, in Matthew 9, where the man was lowered through the roof and Jesus said, Son, your sins are forgiven. The Pharisees said within themselves, This man's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God? And therefore, in saying your sins are forgiven, they realized Jesus was claiming to be God, or to exercise God's prerogatives. And therefore, they sought to kill him. So that was the way the Jews dealt with blasphemers. But not really. Just blasphemers they didn't like. Because the Sanhedrin and many of their own loyalists sometimes blasphemed. You might remember that when Paul went to Pisidian Antioch and preached there, it says in Acts chapter 13, which we read the other day, that many of the people who opposed Paul and Barnabas there spoke evil of the gospel and blasphemed. Now, these were the Jewish leaders in the synagogue. They blasphemed, but they didn't get stoned because they were liked by the Jews. But Jesus wasn't, and therefore they took every opportunity they could to accuse him of blasphemy and take up stones seeking to stone him. Interesting and ironic that he never got stoned. He ended up being crucified rather than stoned. But it does appear that stoning would be what they would have preferred. You remember how they stoned Stephen in Acts chapter 7? That again was for blasphemy because they believed he was blaspheming Moses and the temple, which is kind of a strange thing since blasphemy is ordinarily speaking as God personally. Stephen was accused of blaspheming against Moses and the temple, which shows that the Jews themselves had come to idolize Moses and the temple almost on the same level as God. So that if anyone spoke anything negative about them, it was like blaspheming God himself. But Stephen, of course, was not guilty, but they stoned him anyway. And so the stoning of blasphemers was commanded and first practiced here in Leviticus 24, and we can see that it was still recognized as a valid execution of criminals who blaspheme in even in New Testament times thousands of years later. And the actual stoning of the man is recorded in the last verse of the chapter after several intervening verses. In verse 23 of Leviticus 24, it says, "And Moses spake unto the children of Israel that they should bring forth him that had cursed out of the camp and stone him with stones. And the children of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses." Now between those verses, that is the verses that describe what should be done, and that verse at the end that tells what was done, there's a few verses sandwiched in, verses 17 through 22, that do not appear to be directly related to the story of the blasphemer. And why they're brought up here, I'm not exactly sure. But they are verses that give the law of exact justice, which was the law that made the Jewish legal system stand out above heathen laws much. And that was that the law of Moses said that you could not give a penalty to a criminal that exceeded the significance of the crime. For instance, if a man accidentally injured you and you lost your eye, the court could not declare that the penalty against him would be that he have, you know, both eyes plucked out. Rather, it was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That is usually called the lex talionis, which is the law of exact justice. And this is a very enlightened law in those ancient times, because what it was is it forbade vindictive retaliation. Now, the Jews in Jesus' time had mistakenly felt like eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth was a command. And that if someone hit me and I lost my eye, that I must necessarily vindictively take his eye. And Jesus said, "You have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, do not repay evil. Do not resist the evil man. If a man smite you on one cheek, turn the other cheek also. If a man takes you to court, give him what he asks for and more too. If he forces you to go 1 mile, go 2 voluntarily with him." In other words, rather than taking your legal right of retaliation, which was permitted in the law, just lay down your right. That's what he's saying. Just lay down your right to retaliate. Now, Jesus understood, while the law said that a person could expect exact justice, so that if I lost a tooth, like the guy attacked me and knocked a tooth out of my head, legally I could take him to court and the judge could say, "Okay, just so this will be fair, we'll knock your tooth out. You know, the guy who knocked a tooth out, get one of his knocked out." And that's exact justice. An eye for an eye, or a tooth for a tooth, stroke for stroke, burn for burn, and so forth. The idea was not that if I have a tooth knocked out, I must knock out another man's tooth, as though retaliation is commanded. It simply puts a ceiling on what penalty can be applied to a crime. A judge could not put a penalty upon a crime that exceeded the magnitude of the crime. It had to be at most exact fairness. But still, the injured party always would have the right to waive any right to retaliation. I mean, if I got beat up and lost it in an eye, I would not have to take a tooth and an eye off the guy who beat me up. I could just say, "Well, I forgive you." That's what Jesus was saying to do. Jesus said, "If man smites you on one cheek, turn the other also." Though technically, under the law, if he hits you on one cheek and breaks your cheekbone, well, then you can break one of his cheekbones. Yes, Bruce.
In virtually every society in history up until the Reformation, you know, they would hang people for stealing and cut off their hands and all that.
Right.
So this was in there to limit the authority, you know, the authority of the government.
That's right. It was a very enlightened law for these ancient times, because especially in the Orient, you know, like I said, you can kill people for almost anything. Now, it's interesting that this law of exact justice, which we'll read here, that it's put in this context. Let me read it, and I'll tell you why I find it interesting that it's in this context. In verse 17 it says, "He that killeth any man shall surely be put to death. He that killeth a beast shall make it good, beast for beast. And if a man cause a blemish on his neighbor, as he hath done, so shall it be to him. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he hath caused a blemish in a man, so shall it be done to him again. And he that killeth a beast, he shall restore it. And he that killeth a man shall be put to death. Ye shall have one manner of law, as well for the stranger as for one of your own country, for I am the Lord your God. Now, as you can see, this is just a restatement of that law of exact justice that came up earlier in the book of Exodus. But I think a very interesting position for it, because it's in the context of the blasphemer being stoned to death. It follows immediately after that God commanded that the blasphemer should be stoned to death. And then it's put here, and then after that it describes the blasphemer actually being stoned to death. As though this fits right into the story, although it doesn't appear to, it seems to be something very different. But I think what it is perhaps saying, and the reason it's here, is to say, God does not allow penalties to be exacted that are more severe than the crime. And we should therefore understand that in telling this them to stone the blasphemer, that tells us how great a crime blasphemy is. Because God does not allow vindictive, excessive penalties to be placed upon people for crimes. And yet he has commanded that a blasphemer be stoned to death. And in essence, the two concepts joined together tell us this, that stoning a blasphemer is a fair penalty. It is not excessive. That's what blasphemy rightly would call for. And therefore, of course, it speaks to us of the greatness of the crime, blasphemy. And just as the ugliness of the sacrificial system showed the ugliness of sin itself, because sin itself doesn't seem ugly to us in our natural persons. Before we're regenerated, sin doesn't seem ugly. It is recognized that sin has some unpleasant consequences, but most people like sin. Most people in the world enjoy sin. That's why they do it. And there's a pleasure in sin for a season, the Bible says. And the Bible doesn't deny that. And most of us would not see sin as an ugly thing unless we had some graphic picture given to us showing us how ugly it is. And that is why I believe the sacrificial system was so effective, to show that an innocent victim had to be ruthlessly slaughtered because I sinned. You know, if I sinned, I had to bring a lamb who had done nothing. And it has to have its throat slit, or I had to bring a bird and it had to have its head twisted off, and some, you know, just horrible things are done to this innocent creature. Why? What an ugly practice. And the idea is, yes, it is an ugly practice. If you didn't sin, it wouldn't be necessary. This is the ugliness that sin carries with it, you know? And we wouldn't see sin as an ugly thing unless God gave us a picture of how ugly it is. It must be an ugly disease if it's got such an ugly remedy. And you know, you wouldn't have such an extreme remedy for a disease that was only slight. And so while we might not understand how gross sin is without the sacrificial system, by seeing the bloodbath at the tabernacle, people would just recognize, wow, my sins call for this. There must be something worse about my sins than I thought, you know, or else why all this? And the same thing here, that stoning a blasphemer should convey the idea that blasphemy is worse than we thought, if this is what it calls for. Because God only requires an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and a life for a life and burn for burn and blemish for blemish. Then if a man's going to be stoned to death for blasphemy, that must mean blasphemy is far worse than I would have imagined. And it helps to convey to us the weight and magnitude of that particular sin. Now when we get to chapter 25, we change subjects altogether. And we're more along the lines of the old festivals that we read about in chapter 23, though not exactly. In chapter 23, of course, that chapter was talking about the various appointed times, the special holy days and appointed seasons that the Jews had to observe. Besides the weekly Sabbath day, there was also seven other festivals or feasts during the year that would come up. Well, chapter 5 tells us that there were some other special appointed times, namely the Sabbath year, which was every seventh year, and the year of Jubilee, which was every 50th year. And these were, of course, not included with the festivals in chapter 23 because they weren't observed as regularly, or they weren't a yearly thing. They came up less often. In the case of the Sabbath year, every 7 years. In the case of the Jubilee, only twice in a century. And most people would only live to see one Jubilee year, although almost everyone would live to see one if they lived a natural lifetime, because every 50 years, if a person lived, even if they were born right after the previous Jubilee year, if they lived so much as 50 years long, they'd see the next one. So Jubilee was something that most people would see at least once in their lifetime. And if there was one when they were young, there might be another one before they were dead. You might see two Jubilee years. Now, the law of the Sabbath years and the Jubilee is given chapter 25, which is a long chapter, as you can see. And as far as a Sabbath year, that's dealt with in the first seven verses, and the rest of the chapter deals with Jubilee. Let's read the first seven verses, first of all. And the Lord spake unto Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord. 6 years you shall sow thy field, and 6 years thou shalt prune thy vineyard, and gather the fruit thereof. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land, a Sabbath for the Lord, and shall neither, thou shalt never, neither sow thy field nor prune thy vineyard. That which groweth of its own accord of thy harvest, thou shalt not reap, neither gather the grapes of the vine undressed, for it is a year of rest to the land. And the Sabbath of the land shall be meat to you, for you, or food for you, for thee, and for thy servant, and for thy maid, and for thy hired servant, and for thy stranger that sojourneth with thee, and for thy cattle, and for the beasts that are in thy land, shall all the increase thereof be meat. Now, it's kind of confusing there, because in the first five verses, it basically says that every seventh year, they must let all the land lie fallow. And they can't harvest even that which grows by itself. They don't plant any crops that year. But, of course, from the previous year's harvest, there would have been some seed that had fallen on the ground, and so some plants would have sprung up anyway. But they weren't allowed to go and harvest those. Where it's confusing is in verses 6 and 7, it says that year shall be meat for you. Where it seems like the opposite is true. If you can't harvest, it seems like that year would be no food for you. But maybe what he's saying is that the very rest will be, in a sense, your refreshing, your meat. Remember how Jesus said, I have meat that you know not of, or literally, I have food that you know not of, to do the will of my Father is my food. Remember Jesus said that to his disciples in John chapter 4. Maybe that's the sense in which this is used here, that just as Jesus was nourished by doing the will of his Father and was not living by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, so these people, the seventh year, they would not be living by bread alone, they would be living by just obeying God. Now, that doesn't mean they wouldn't be eating, because it says later in the chapter very clearly that God would give them an abundant harvest on the sixth year, enough to last through the Sabbath year, if they would obey Him. If they would obey Him, He would give them enough in the sixth year to last. And this is very similar, of course, to how He provided manna in the wilderness. Now, this law that's been given does not apply to them in the wilderness, because they didn't cultivate crops in the wilderness. They just wandered and ate manna. This was a law that would come into force when they made it into Canaan and when they would begin to have the farms. But you can see the same principle was going on while they were in the wilderness with the manna, because they were told to gather manna only 6 days and then on the seventh day not go out and gather any. And God would give them twice as much on the sixth day to make up for the seventh. And whereas the manna would ordinarily breed worms and stink if you kept it overnight, yet on the sixth day a miracle would be done in keeping it fresh for the next day, because obedience to God would bring God's hand blessing supernaturally into their agriculture and into their need for food and so forth. So he said if they would observe the Sabbath years, they wouldn't be hungry the seventh year, because God would have provided the sixth year for extra. Now, we find that the Jews never obeyed this law, nor the Jubilee law. The laws in chapter 25 never were kept by the Jews. In fact, in 2 Chronicles, we read that it's partly because of this that they went 70 years into captivity in Babylon, so that the land of Israel, in their absence, could observe its Sabbaths. It says that in the 36th chapter of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20 and 21, says, And them that had escaped from the sword, Nebuchadnezzar carried away into Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the king of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath, to fulfill 70 years. Now what it's saying here is that in taking the people out of the land, God was permitting the land to experience its Sabbath that it hadn't ever had before. All the years that they've been in it, for hundreds of years they had neglected to keep the seventh year of Sabbath. And so God gave the land 70 straight years of Sabbath to make up for all the Sabbaths it had missed. And it was obviously a judgment to be brought upon them. Now, besides being a year of letting the land lie fallow, every seventh year was also, it also had some other social ramifications. It's not brought up in this chapter, but in other places it is. And that is that every seventh year, called the year of release, it would be not only a Sabbath, also a year of release from all debt and from all bondage. And if a Jew had gone into debt because of his own poverty, he had to borrow money from a fellow Jew. If he'd gone into debt, his debt would be canceled on the year of release, which was the Sabbath year. And, of course, you might say, well, that would be kind of, that would lead people to be cautious about lending if the Sabbath year was coming up. Because if, for instance, in the sixth year, just before the Sabbath year, someone came to you and wanted to borrow money, you might say, no way, because next year I'd have to cancel the debt, you know. But the law actually said that you shall not withhold money in your lending to your brother just because of the consideration of the Sabbath year, but you shall still be generous. If you'd look at Deuteronomy 15, for instance, where this is discussed, actually the first 15 verses of Deuteronomy 15 talk about this Sabbath year, this the year of release, as they called it. It says in verse 1, Deuteronomy 15:1, at the end of every 7 years, thou shalt make a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Or a foreigner, thou mayest exact it again. Of a foreigner you may exact it again. But that which is thine with thy brother, thine hand shall release. Now this policy only applied to doing it with your brother. Now that would be a Jew with another Jew. If there was some principle that carried over to the Christian, it would be Christians dealing with other Christians. It was very clear that to with a Gentile, if a Gentile owed you money, you did not, a Jew did not have to cancel his debt at the year of release. This had to do with rather keeping justice and equality among the brethren. And that's an interesting concept that comes up also in the New Testament that we could talk about. But anyway, it goes on to say in verse 4, save, that is, except when there shall be no more poor among you. When you come to the time where there's no poor, then you can stop doing this. Now, that's kind of ironic because he says in verse 11, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. In other words, he's not saying the time will come when there's no poor. What he's saying is, as long as there are poor, you need to observe this custom. Because poor people need to borrow money. And yet, poor people very often, God made a provision that those who are rich enough to lend to the poor should cancel the debts every 7 years. Now, this also applied to a person being sold into slavery. It says in verse 7, if there be among you a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of the gates of thy land, and the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and shalt surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he lacketh. Beware that there be not a thought of thy wickedness, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him nothing, and he cry unto the Lord against thee, and it be a sin unto thee. Thou shalt surely give it him. Thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless you in all your works, and in all that thou puttest thine hand unto. For the poor shall never see out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, and to the needy in thy land. Then it says also, and if thy brother, an Hebrew man, or an Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee, and serve you 6 years, this is as a slave, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee, and when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of your flock, and out of your floor, that is your threshing floor, your grain, and out of thy winepress. Of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. Thou shalt remember that thou wast bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee. Therefore I command thee this thing today. Now, notice the year of release, the seventh year, involved not only letting the land rest, but also canceling debts and releasing any Hebrew slaves. Now, Gentile slaves, And Gentiles who owed debts to the Jews would not be released at this time, but the Jews would. And this was, of course, in order to preserve equality and unity within the country. You can see that this would make it impossible for some things to happen, as, for instance, happened in our country, where people can exploit the poor and get people greatly indebted for life to them, where a person is in bondage to his debts for the rest of his life because he can never pay them off. This wouldn't happen here. The person who was rich was obligated to lend to his brother. And if his brother couldn't pay it back in 7 years or by the seventh year, then the rich was obligated to let it go. I guess it was presumed that if you could live without it that long, you could live without it definitely. If you could lend it for 7 years and not see it in that time, then you must not need it very badly to live on. And so you can cancel it altogether. Notice this means, especially when it says, beware that there be an evil heart in you that says, hey, the seventh year is near, I'm not going to lend to my brother. He says, you lend anyway. It's clear that the Old Testament is teaching the same thing that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, that you should lend, not expecting to return, not expect anything in return. Though the Jews could expect that if they were lending to an honest man, that he would try to pay them back in the allotted time. Yet it was clear that if he couldn't pay them back in 7 years, he'd be free. So in a sense, a person had to lend not really expecting to get anything back, because if the person could avoid paying off the debt in 7 years, that was the statute of limitations for every debt. And it's kind of interesting how a lot of laws today still have a 7-year statute of limitations. Did you have a question, buddy? Okay. You know, I had a thought about this. I was just going to say, now it's slipped my mind. But yeah, you know, I was thinking about some things. There's different laws. I'm trying to remember which ones. What's that? Is car insurance one of them?
Well, if you don't pay in a certain amount of time, you're released from it if you get the
money. Yeah, there are. Well, statutes of limitations means that if you commit a crime or you incur a debt and somehow you manage not to be caught for a certain number of years, if you're caught after that time, you're immune because the statute of limitations has run out. They have to catch you within a certain period of time of the crime. Even some of the old common law marriage laws had to do with a 7-year statute. If you could make it together for 7 years, illegally as it were, or without legal marriage, then you got automatically the benefits of legal marriage or whatever. So it's kind of interesting how the 7-year statute has come into some of our modern laws, and it sort of goes back to this Sabbath year principle that if a person couldn't pay off his debt and could avoid paying off his debt for 7 years, then he was free from it. The only thing is, of course, an honest man would not wish to take advantage that way, and he'd try to pay off in the 7 years. I know that my father-in-law, even before he was a Christian, one of his ventures pretty much went bankrupt, and he was left in debt to the tune of many thousands of dollars to people, and he was in the position legally that he could have filed for bankruptcy and been free of all his debts, but he just didn't feel that was fair, and he felt like he owed the people fair and square, and he wasn't just going to take a legal loophole to get out, and he spent years paying them off. It was difficult to do, but that's what an honest man will do. And so even a person who owed money, and of course the statute of limitations came up, the Sabbath year, the year of release came, probably an honest man would still wish to pay back his creditors if he could. But at least if a man is hopelessly, you know, poverty-stricken and there was no hope of him ever paying it back, he wouldn't have to live with this over his head for more than 7 years. And the man who lent money would have to take that into consideration. But he couldn't decline to lend on the basis of that consideration. Yes, Bruce?
Well, there's something before, we're taking four in the land.
Uh-huh.
There was a place, maybe it was in the agenda, but you know, because God says, I'll take all the poor out of your land and they'll park them under me.
Oh, I think that might be in Deuteronomy.
Yeah, but then he says, the poor is never going to cease.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a hint that he is not expecting him to keep the law here. He even told Moses, he said, I know these people are stiff-necked. And, you know, he said, you know, I think of poor people, there won't be any poor people to keep my commandments, but there's always going to be poor people.
Yeah.
I always thought that was very rough. You know,
yeah, I think that's in Deuteronomy 15 also. I was thinking about that this morning too when I was reading this, because it says this law applies except when there shall be no more poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it. Only if you carefully hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God to observe to all these commandments which I command thee to say, for the Lord thy God blesseth thee, as he promised, and you shall lend to many nations and shall not borrow, and thou shalt reign and not be reigned over, and so forth. In other words, if you carefully hearken to my laws, then I'll bless you and you won't be poor. But then later he says, but there will always be poor. So implying you won't hearken to my laws. Yeah, God knew they wouldn't. Yes? Yeah, it's interesting. Well, we're not going through Deuteronomy now, or else we could spend more time on Deuteronomy 15, but it is interesting that he says, for the poor you will always be here in the land. That's essentially what Jesus was quoting when he said, the poor you'll have with you always. But the interesting thing is that Moses was saying, the poor will always be in the land, therefore you shall stretch out your hand and help them. Jesus quoted it to the opposite effect, essentially, not canceling it out, but just because Judas had said, this could have been sold and given to the poor. And Jesus essentially said, you'll always have the poor. You can give them whatever you want to, but me you have not always with you. And he was basically justifying the woman not giving to the poor because there will always be poor to give to. Whereas the verse he's quoting from Deuteronomy is essentially saying the opposite in a way. It's saying you'll always have poor in the land, therefore you should give to them. You know, since there will always be an obligation upon us, there will always be people who need our generosity. We should always be in the habit of giving it. But Jesus took it and saw another angle to the same truth. Since there are always poor people, there might be occasions where some things are more urgent than relieving the poor, because, like in his case, he was going to die, and the woman had used the ointment to anoint him for burial, which he thought was more suited to the moment, and there would always be opportunity to help the poor after that. So, kind of interesting use, but we're not in Deuteronomy right now.
Yeah, Bruce. I think what the Lord is saying is that we're supposed to help the poor, but that's not the first thing. Our first lavish attention, our first, you know, that which we give most is to come toward God. And then we're to help the poor, that's the second commandment. Let's not forget about the first one.
That's right. I think that's in that whole story too, where Jesus commended the woman who had poured out this extravagant gift upon him in what seemed like a very unpractical use of that ointment. You know, I mean, here it was worth a year's wages for a common laborer. You know, today that'd be what, $10,000, $15,000, maybe $20,000. What's a year's wages for an average middle class person? How much? $10,000. Okay, so or $8,000. Someone said that. Can you imagine having a jar of liquid that's worth $8,000 or $10,000, and then, you know, pouring it over someone's head? You can imagine certain Christians that we know saying, hey, wait a minute, that should have been sold and given to the poor. Give all the hungry in Ethiopia. You know, you're wasting this. And but Jesus, right, as Bruce was saying, yeah, it is important to feed the poor, but it's never a waste to lavish your resources on Jesus, on him personally, your love. What this woman was doing was just showing her love for him personally. And it's not as though God is so poor that he couldn't, if he wished, provide his church with enough money to feed all the poor also. But the fact was, she was putting Jesus, in a sense, before the poor. And that's what Judas objected to, he said. Well, of course, Judas had other motives for saying it, we know. But he was ostensibly objecting to the fact that Jesus was being placed above the poor in this situation. And Jesus was saying, I should be placed above the poor. And like Bruce was saying, the first commandment is to love your Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And second is to love your neighbor. So, to lavish it on Jesus first is not wrong. Yes, Cynthia? In Deuteronomy?
Well, anytime you talk about the poor, you know, there always be the poor in my life, well, there always be people who don't know him.
In the New Testament, I think you'll find the word poor used that way more frequently. I don't think it's very often carries that meaning in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there wasn't very much of a spiritual... Actually, the Old Testament didn't have a lot of spiritual emphasis at all. It was mainly just rich according to this world and poor according to this world. Where Jesus, interestingly, Jesus in Luke chapter 6 said, blessed are you poor, But in what seems to be a parallel in Matthew, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit, you know. So poor in spirit seem to be set in parallel with the poor in the New Testament, but not so much in the Old Testament, at least not evidently. Okay, we better talk about the year of Jubilee. That's what remains to us here. In the rest of chapter 25 of Leviticus, I don't know whether we should read all these verses or just talk about them. The year of Jubilee was measured by, it was the year after the seventh Sabbath year. Now remember, every seventh year was a Sabbath year. So the first Sabbath year would be after 7 years, the next one would be after 14, and seven of them would make 49 years. And the year after the seventh Sabbath was a special year, the year of Jubilee. It's sort of like Pentecost was measured that way. 7 weeks after the first fruits offering was made, then the day after the seventh week, you know, it's like 7 times 7 days was significant. And then the next day was the 50th day, the day of Pentecost. So also with the years, 7 times 7 years was significant. The seventh Sabbath year, the next year was a significant year. The 50th year was the year of Jubilee. The word Jubilee seems to be related to the Hebrew word for trumpet. It's not real certain what the word Jubilee means exactly. In the margin of my Bible, where it says in verse 9 here, then thou shalt cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound. The Hebrew apparently reads the trumpet of the loud sound, or loud of sound. Came to be called the year of Jubilee, though it was never practiced by the Jews. On the 50th year, they'd blow the trumpet of Jubilee. Throughout then, the trumpet would be blown, and this would be a proclamation that the Jubilee had come. And this was blown on the Day of Atonement of the 50th year. That is, the 10th day of the 7th month, which is happened to be Yom Kippur, of the 50th year. And this would be every 50 years on the Day of Atonement. They were supposed to sound the trumpet audibly so that everyone in the land could know that when the trumpet sounded, all slaves were free, all prisoners in jail were released, and most significantly, and certainly that which is discussed the most at length in the passage, all the land that had been forfeited because of debt or because of poverty reverted to its original owners. Now, we haven't studied Joshua yet, so you might not be able to appreciate the setting for how this Jubilee was to be practiced yet. But at the end of Joshua, after Joshua had led the armies of Israel to conquer all the land of Canaan, Joshua divided by lot, that's by casting lots, the land to the various tribes, and each family in each of the tribes got its own parcel of land. And that parcel of land would be forever the possession of that family. And God desired that there would never come a time where there were land barons in Israel that took advantage of the poor and bought their land and took it from them and kept it in perpetuity so that the children of the poor would have no inheritance. He desired that every family would be able to leave a real estate inheritance to their children. So there would always be a place for them in Israel. That God's people would always have a place that had their name on it. That would be theirs. Now, in the meantime, it was not illegal for them to sell their land. But it was impossible for the land to stay out of their family's hands for very long. Because what would happen if you'd sell your land, you would lose it until the year of Jubilee. But when the year of Jubilee had come, the land would automatically go back to your family again. And some of the verses of this chapter deal with the way that you're supposed to prorate the value of the land calculated from the coming year of Jubilee. Because obviously, if I was a poor person and I was ready to sell my family parcel to get out of poverty, and the year of Jubilee was next year, I could only get a small price for the land, because obviously the person who's buying it from me would only get to use it for a year before I got it back. And presumably his use of it would be for growing crops, and there'd be certain revenues generated on the land, and that's why he would buy it from me in the first place. He's really just renting the land. That's really what it gets down to. You never really could buy land to become yours. You'd be buying it, but it would really amount to a lease. You're really leasing the property to grow crops and hopefully earn revenues for yourself in the years that you can control it. But when the year of Jubilee comes, you've got no more control over it. It goes back to the original owner. So that no one could stay poor for more than a lifetime. For even, like I said, 50 years is rich. Most people live that long. And so almost everybody would live to see at least 1 year of Jubilee, and if it happened to be positioned right, you might see 2 years of Jubilee. So that within the lifetime of most people, everything would revert to how it was, and it would be impossible for someone to buy up all the land and generation after generation to be for one wealthy family, you know, one group of, you know, Rockefellers or DuPonts or someone, you know, to rise up in Israel, who, as the generations went by, they just bought up and swallowed up more of the land until they owned the whole country. See? But they could buy as much as they wanted in their lifetime, but when the year of Jubilee came, they didn't own any of it again. They just had their original family parcel. And this, in other words, the year of Jubilee did for the land what the Sabbath year did to debts and to bondage. Between the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee, God had arrangements so that debts and bondage and permanent loss of property were pretty much eliminated from that society. Even though slavery was not forbidden, a person could not be a slave for more than 7 years without his approval. Now, we read in Exodus that a person who had been a slave for 7 years had to be offered his freedom. But if he wanted to remain a slave, for instance, if he thought he was more secure as the slave of a rich man than he would be out there trying to make a living on his own, he could stay a slave. But after the Sabbath year, if he wanted to remain a slave, he'd have to have his ear pierced, which would indicate that he was now a permanent lifetime slave. This is called a bond slave. He would be one who was a slave for life by choice, because he had been offered his freedom, but he chose to remain a slave. What we can see is that God had a real concern for social justice, though he did not legislate all the things that we might have sensitivities about. For instance, he didn't legislate against polygamy, which is something we have sensitivities about, or against slavery per se, which we have sensitivities about. Yet you can see that he did set the laws for the time. It really shows what we would recognize as a real enlightened concern for the poor and for avoiding, you know, people getting very rich at the expense of the very poor and people losing their inheritance so they had no place to live. And so the year of Jubilee primarily is to proclaim that everybody now has a place to call their own again. Everyone now has their own place again in the kingdom. It's kind of interesting. Even though the Jews never practiced the year of Jubilee, as far as we know, they never did it, yet there are Old Testament passages that suggest that they were aware of it. If you look at Nehemiah, for example, chapter 5, when Nehemiah brought people back with him from the Babylonian captivity to rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem, he ran into all kinds of problems. Most of the problems he faced were from enemies outside, the Samaritan rulers who didn't want the project to continue. And so Nehemiah's life was threatened, intimidated, and mocked, and had all kinds of problems from outsiders. But he also ran into problems within the society of the Jews in Jerusalem. And in Nehemiah chapter 5, beginning with verse 1, it says, "And there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren the Jews, for there were that said, 'We, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore we take up corn for them, that we may eat and live.' Some also there were that said, 'We have mortgaged our lands, vineyards and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth.' There were also some that said, 'We have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and our vineyards.'" That is, using their lands and vineyards as collateral, they borrowed money just to pay the tribute to the rulers. "Now, yet now our flesh, each of our brothers, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and our vineyards." Now, what it's saying here is that some people had fallen on hard times, and they'd had to sell their lands and their vineyards to other Jews. And then they still needed money, and they didn't have any lands to use as collateral anymore, because their lands were now more, you know, in the hands of these other people. So they now had to sell their sons and daughters into slavery in order to do it. Now, this made Nehemiah real mad, because he saw that there were Jews, rich Jews, taking advantage of poor Jews in the city. And here he was thinking, you know, we have enough problem with the people on the outside without having these kind of strife within. And it says in verse 6, "And Nehemiah said, 'I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself.'" He had a quick consultation with himself. "I rebuked the nobles And the ruler said unto them, ye exact usury, that's excessive interest, every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them, and I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold to the heathen. And will ye even sell your brethren, or shall ye they be sold unto us? Then held they their peace, and found nothing to answer. And I said, it's not good that ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God, because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise, and my brethren and my servants, might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, their houses, also the hundredth part of the money, and of the corn, and of the wine, and the oil that ye exact of them. And they said, we will restore them. Then it says in verse 13, and I also shook my lap and said, so God shall shake every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise. Even thus he shall be shaken out and emptied. Now, this was not the year of Jubilee. I mean, we don't have any record that this was the 50th year. Yet the concept of persons taking advantage of the poor and buying their lands and taking everything they had from them was abhorrent to Nehemiah. Nehemiah was very much a man with God's heart, and he really knew what was on God's mind. And he realized that some people, instead of being interested in the project of building the city, which was of mutual benefit to all, were interested simply in building their own little empires within the city at the expense of others. And that they were just opportunists using their wealth to build up their kingdom more. And Nehemiah, the year of Jubilee, yet he kind of decreed his own year of Jubilee and says, listen, all of you give the lands back to everyone. Now, he was the supreme ruler. He could do that. He was authorized by the king of Persia, who was their absolute monarch that they had to bow to do whatever he wanted. So he could sort of go in and proclaim his own Jubilee. And that's essentially what he did. Even though they never observed the Jubilee at the right time, he knew that this was on God's heart, that the poor would not be exploited like this and that their lands wouldn't be taken from them. And so this is probably the closest thing the Jews ever had in their history to observing the year of Jubilee. In Isaiah 61, there is what appears to be a reference to Jubilee from this prophet. And it's a messianic prophecy Jesus quoted about himself in Luke 4. But it's Isaiah 61, verses 1 through 3. The prophet says, the Spirit of the Lord God is on me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings to the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, and the day of the vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, and to give unto them beauty for ashes, oil of joy for mourning, and the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, and that they might be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he might be glorified. Now there's many things in this prophecy that point to an allusion to the year of Jubilee. First of all, he mentions particularly that he's sent to proclaim liberty in verse 1. To proclaim liberty. This is actually an expression from Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25:10 says, and ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof, and it shall be a jubilee unto you. That's Leviticus 25:10. It says, you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land. Well, here the prophet says, the Lord has anointed me to proclaim liberty. And then, of course, to the opening of the prison to those who are bound. The release of prisoners was part of the Jubilee provisions. And then in verse 2, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. The acceptable year of the Lord in this connection obviously has to do with the year of Jubilee. He says that God has sent me to proclaim the Jubilee year, to proclaim liberty to those who are captives, to open the prisons for those who are bound. And of course, it would also imply giving back original possessions to those who had had them. Now, the prophet was not saying that at the moment he was prophesying this, which was 600 years or 800 years before Christ, Isaiah was not saying that this happens to be a year of Jubilee at the moment he's speaking it. He's prophesying of the Messiah. And this is a messianic prophecy. And Jesus quoted it in Luke 4. And I'd like you to see the connection there. Luke chapter 4. Jesus was asked to speak in the synagogue in his hometown of Nazareth. And Luke 4:17 is where we begin. It says, "And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, 'The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach good news, or the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, the recovering of sight to those who are blind, and to set at liberty them that are bruised, and to preach the acceptable year of the Lord.'" It says, "Then he closed the book, and he gave it to the minister again, and he sat down. And the eyes of all that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, 'This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears.'" In other words, this very day was the fulfillment of that scripture. Isaiah 800 years earlier, and essentially said, "God has anointed me to preach a year of Jubilee." And Jesus said, that was talking about now. That was talking about me. I'm the one who's anointed to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. I'm the one who's anointed to preach liberty to the captives. But note, it was a spiritual jubilee that he was proclaiming. He wasn't involved in social action in Israel. He didn't go to Pilate and say, "Now open all those prisons and let those guys out of there." And he didn't go to the Jews and say, "Now you give this land back to these people who had it before." That's not what he was involved in. He was proclaiming a different kind of jubilee. He was proclaiming a spiritual jubilee, that those who had been sold into captivity and debt to Satan would be released from that through the preaching of the gospel, and that the acceptable time for this release had come, and that the original possession of the earth, which had been taken by Satan from man, was now to be restored, and the meek were now to inherit the earth, as Jesus said in one of the Beatitudes, that he had come to redeem the earth back for man, basically, for God's people, and to redeem it back from its having been lost to Satan previously. So there's a spiritual jubilee here that Jesus proclaimed, and we can assume, since Jesus spoke on this wise, that even when the law was first given, and though it was not practiced literally by the Jews at any time, yet it looked forward to the coming of Christ. The whole principle of the jubilee's law was that it looks forward to Jesus coming and proclaiming a liberty and a restoration of the earth to its original inhabitants and its original owners. You see, when God made the heavens and the earth and made man, he made man to have dominion over the earth. And he gave man dominion, but we know that when man sinned, he lost his control, because man himself became a puppet of the enemy. Man himself became a slave of sin. Jesus said, "Whosoever commits sin is a slave of sin." And so man sold himself into slavery and lost, of course, his control of the earth that had been given to him. Yet, ultimately, God desires that the meek will inherit the earth. The earth will go back to those who are God's people. And it is only possible because Jesus has paid the price of redemption for the whole world. And now he is able, like Nehemiah was able, to command the rich to give the land back to their original owners. So Jesus has the authority to command Satan to release the world and to give it back to God's people, the original owners. And those are some of the thoughts that seem to be embodied in the year of Jubilee. There are some Christians today, notably, I think Ron Sider is his name, who wrote Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger. Is that his name? Anyway, anyone read that book? It's amazing that no one's read that book. That was an extremely popular book. Yeah, I read it years ago, and it seemed like everyone was reading it then. But it was a real popular book a while ago called Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger. We've got it in the library. But the fellow who wrote that suggested that he's he's an evangelical, but he's kind of into a liberation theology kind of thing and into redistribution of the wealth of the world and so forth. And he kind of advocates the church should start observing a jubilee, I guess every 50 years or whatever, and that should be characterized by a redistribution of wealth. It's been so long since I read the book, I don't remember exactly what he suggests, but I know that he goes to that year of Jubilee and indicates that since the Jews didn't keep it, God nonetheless expected it to be kept, and maybe the Christians should be keeping it. But I think the Jubilee year is not necessarily something that Christians are supposed to physically be keeping, but rather it is a spiritual type and a symbol of the liberty that Jesus proclaimed. And it is a type of the church age. After all the Sabbath years were over, then came the end of the age, the 50th year, the last days, the time that Jesus came and proclaim liberty, and we live in that final age right now. It's kind of been an extended jubilee year ever since Jesus came and until he comes again. Yes, sir?
I think in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul mentions the bondman is Christ, free man, and free man is Christ.
I thought of that scripture today too, yeah, and he said, you're bought with a price, be not the servants of men, meaning he was writing to Christian slaves. And yeah, I was thinking about that this morning, how that Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 was talking to slaves. He said, if you're a slave, care not for it. In other words, don't worry about it. But he said, if you have opportunity to be free, use it, rather. But he said, a man who is a slave who belongs to Christ is a free man in Christ, in a sense. Even though he's a slave socially by status, he's yet free in the Lord. But a free man who becomes a Christian becomes the Lord's slave. So that whether you're a slave or free, as a Christian, you're both a slave and free anyway. So he said it doesn't really make that much difference as far as the social institution, but you are set free from a certain kind of slavery by being a Christian. And there's other places. You know, we're set free from a lot of different slaveries. And if you read Galatians, it says we've been set free from the law, and we need to stand in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free and not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage, meaning to the law. And in Romans chapter 6, it talks about how we were slaves of sin, but now we're servants of God and servants of righteousness. So there's very clearly many images in the New Testament that are brought out that speak of us being released from slavery. It calls to mind the Sabbath years and the Jubilee year particularly. Again, the Sabbath year primarily dealt with the release of debt and slaves, whereas the Jubilee year mainly included those things. It also had the release of debt and the release of slaves, but it also had the release of the land back to its original owners. And it just not only points forward to what Jesus would do spiritually, but it also shows God's concern that there be something of an equality among the people of God.
Verse 23 just really put that whole chapter into perspective.
Why don't you read that verse I've got?
The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, you are but aliens.
That's good. The Lord said, the land shall not be sold permanently because the land is mine, and you people are only aliens. And that's very important for us to understand about the Jews' right to the land. Because some Christians just assume that God gave them the land, and that it's theirs, no matter what they do. But God said, it's not yours. You're just tenants. It's my land. You're taking care of it for me. And he made it very clear in many places, if you don't take good care of it, you'll be gone. But it'll still be my land. You know, it's not theirs, it's his. And therefore, only when the Jews were obedient to God did they really even have any claim to being there. Because he always made it clear that if they forsook his covenant, that he'd drive them out of the land and it wouldn't be theirs anymore. Yeah, Earl?
There's a saying called God's country, which is a place that's so elegant that it's really privileged to live there.
Up in Montana and stuff, and you go there and people say it's God's country. Yeah. Well, Psalm 24:1 says, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Yeah, he's, in a sense, it's still his. Yeah, continue, I didn't catch the whole thought there. Right. So, in other words, whatever we produce, even though we produce them by our labors, they're still God's, because he not only gave us the energy to do it, but also the resources. Everything we have is the Lord's. Okay. Well, we're just about on time to quit here.